Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. My guest is Denny Rancourt. Good to have Denny back again. We've talked about his situation up in Ottawa and the persecution that he's gone through at the expense of the University of Ottawa and the terrible injustice done to him and what he's been going through for months and months and months. We want to review one on this program. I support Denny wholeheartedly. He's been on the program a number of times. I've written about him before. I'll do it again. I absolutely abhor injustice, and Denny has been going through it much too long. Denny, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Stephen. Yeah,
Denny,
I'm glad to be back.
Oh, it's terrific having you on. We very much are allied toward the same thing. Justice. Nothing short of justice. Bring listeners up to date on what's been going on.
Oh, so much. You know, I'm a busy person these days. I'm fighting in the courts, and there are the oral hearings, the tribunal hearings into my dismissal case are this month and next month, May and June. And so it's a very, very busy time. I've just come out of last week a cross-examination that lasted more than 4 days, and it's still not over. It will continue when the hearings start up again. But this is the lawyer for the university that cross-examines me. So there's it's quite an experience to be cross-examined by an aggressive and experienced trial lawyer. And one of the first battles, well, I could get right into it now, or I could give you first a sort of an overview of everything that's happening. I'm also, I have a case, as you know, at the Supreme Court of Canada, and I recently filed my reply submissions in that case, and I've got another appeal at the Ontario Court of Appeal, which is the highest court in this province, where I just recently sent 40 pounds of documents to the court, which is my submissions, and now I'm awaiting their submissions. So these are all in relation to the civil lawsuit that the University of Ottawa is funding against me. It's a defamation lawsuit. My opinion is that it's a slap suit. It's a strategic litigation against public participation. And well, there's just so many things. That gives you a sense of it. But just to give you a concrete example of how there are so many things, on May 13th, which was a Monday, here's what my day was like. I get up at 5 a.m. I call the printer, a professional printer at home, to tell him I was going to be in early because I absolutely needed documents. I met him at 8 a.m. at downtown at the print shop. He produced, while I waited, some books of documents that were to be copied and bound that I needed to bring to the Supreme Court because that was my deadline. I took some of those copies and I served them personally to the university lawyer and to the lawyer of Professor St. Louis, who is the professor whose lawsuit is funded against me in the civil litigation case. So I served those two parties. That means I walked downtown and I went to each of their offices and served them. Then I walked to where my hearings were for the dismissal case, the tribunal on my dismissal, which started at 9:30. When I got there early, I asked one of the union lawyers to certify my affidavit of service that I had served these two guys because I needed a lawyer or some kind of a court officer to certify my affidavit. They did that. I made a copy. Then we had the hearings. I was cross-examined. Then at the lunch break, I had to go to the Supreme Court of Canada with my affidavit of service and file the documents that I'd served in that morning because it was the deadline. And I had to go to I got some help with the latter one. I had to go to the Superior Court of Ontario to file other documents that were due on the same day. Of course, they like to pile up the deadlines to make it difficult for you and make sure that you have to do all this on a day when you have a hearing and you're being cross-examined. But I got it all done, and then I went back in the afternoon to continue my cross-examination until the end of the day. And the next day, the cross-examination started over again. That gives you a sense of what my days can be like on a busy day.
Eddie, for a man who is a distinguished, world-recognized physics professor, an expert, an environmental scientist, it's astonishing what they're putting you through. Instead of letting you use your talents to benefit other people, the University of Ottawa, which is really more like a fascist dictatorship, is putting you through this, and it's funding this slap lawsuit, and that's all it is. It literally is putting up roadblocks against you. It just wants to come at you hammer and tongue. Talk about gross injustice. You and my friend Lynn Stewart, who's wrongfully imprisoned, you're both going through the closest thing I know to the trials of Job.
Yes, well, I'm not in prison, thankfully. A lot of people would like to put me there, but
They want to bankrupt you first, did any? That's what they want to do.
Yes. Well, they're succeeding in doing that. That's for sure. I mean, I'm now at the end of my rope in terms of even just, you know, when I went to the printer, I told that story. Well, you have to pay the man, you know, because if you don't pay for these basic services that you need, you can't proceed with your own defense in the courts. So I'm at that level now where there's a lot of generous people who are sending me donations, and I'm able to just scrape by with the court fees and the binding fees and all that kind of stuff.
Denny,
but yes, they are.
Tell listeners how they can contribute any amount, $5, $10, any amount, to a defense that is absolutely honorable, just, and necessary. Tell them how to do it.
Well, I would appreciate any donation, and so it's very easy. You can just Google my name, and you know, Denis Rancourt, and you'll find my blogs. And both of my blogs, one is called U of O Watch, and the other is called Activist Teacher. Near the top of the page on those blogs, there's a donate button or a link that says how to donate. For example, the U of O Watch blog has a donate button that looks like a PayPal button. And it takes you to a page that with a PayPal connection and everything, and you can donate that way. But I'm glad you asked me about my blogs.
Eddie, I just remind listeners, you are going up against the deep-pocketed University of Ottawa funding the lawsuit against you, no matter how much it costs. Two of the major law firms of Canada are representing St. Louis.
And the University of Ottawa. So that's right. The large law firm Gowling's is representing St. Louis, and BLG, which I think is the third largest law firm in Canada, if it's not the second now, is representing the University of Ottawa. And both of the lead lawyers have formally represented prime ministers of Canada. In their lawsuits. So these are like top litigants. They're trial lawyers. They're very experienced. They get the top rates. And these are the two men that I oppose. I'm facing them in court when we argue motions. And they have teams behind them and junior lawyers running around and getting them things and so on. And I'm standing there alone with my documents prepared always at the last minute because they never give me enough time to actually prepare as well as I would like to, but I do the best I can. And sometimes I even win the arguments. Which is, you know, whenever I win an argument in court, I'm always very surprised because of the asymmetry of resources and time. And, you know, I really have a sense that there's a bias against any litigant that self-represents themselves. The judges in Ontario tend to think that if you're self-represented, you can't possibly be honest, that you must be so biased in your presentation that nothing you say can be trusted. You know, they tend to have, my sense is, this is my opinion, but they tend to have that opinion, whereas they treat the opposing lawyers as so-called officers of the court, as though these guys were telling the objective truth all the time. And of course, whenever I catch them not telling the objective truth, it's never a lie. It's just an error, or it's just you know, they got mixed up for a bit. It was never intentional, even though it's very prejudicial against me and so on. Right?
Oh, indeed.
And this happens all the time. Like, I don't understand how these hyper-experienced lawyers who at the top of their fields can make errors and tell judges things that are clearly not true based on the documents. This has happened several times.
Well, they gave me the system, and of course the judges that adjudicate in their cases. I mean, these people are buddies. They probably belong to the same clubs. Their families probably know each other. They may go out to dinner with each other. They may even do what they're not supposed to do, discuss cases out of the courtroom. Who knows what these people do, Denny?
Well, I wouldn't to venture an opinion in that direction, but I do know that one time I was sent an email by accident, and the email showed that one of the lawyers had information about what the judges, when he would be off on vacation. So, I was very concerned about this. How can you have that kind of information? And of course, that's the kind of information that is very useful when you're doing, when you're planning a litigation and so on, right? So, yeah, there are all kinds of things that are of concern. I mean, every once in a while, the lawyers have to say, oh, no, can't use that judge. Our wives are friends or whatever, you know. I mean, it's pretty...
Oh, it doesn't happen very often. I don't know what they do or what they don't do, Denny, but the system really is rigged against individuals going up against the system, and certainly the University of Ottawa and these major law firms are part of the system, and the judges are part of it, and it's the same way in America. You've got conservative elements running things, and ordinary people don't have, or in most cases at least, don't have a chance against them. If they want to rig the proceeding against you, if they want you to lose and the other side to win, they're going to make sure it comes out that way, so you really have your hands full going up against these folks. And you're not alone. You're learning the law as you go along.
Yeah, I certainly feel that way as a self-represented person. I really have, you know, you really have a hard time. They interrupt you in court when you're trying to make your arguments. They assume that you're saying things that are not relevant to the case, and they try to guide you even before you've had a chance to say what you're trying to say. This is just so impolite and just so disrespectful. To not listen to what you're saying before you interject to tell the person that, you know, that it's not relevant or that you need to focus on this other thing. Whereas when the lawyers open their mouths, they can go on as long as they want. They never get interrupted. And they can say things that are purely said to be prejudicial against me. You know, it has no value to the motion at bar before the court when they say it. And the judges just listen to it and nod their heads and it just goes on, you know? So, yeah, I definitely feel that there's an imbalance. But having said that, there are some judges and arbitrators that appear to me to be very fair-minded. And they do try. I mean, they don't want to, you know, be unfair to either side. They really try to understand what the case is about. Like, they'll ask questions. You can tell. You know, sometimes you're before a judge and all they want to do is figure out how to nail you. That's the impression you get from the questions they're asking. And other times you really get the impression that the judge is just trying to figure out what the heck is going on here. You know, like who said what, when, because it's complicated, right? And you're being accused of so many things and they're just loading it on. So the judge is just trying to, you know, peel the layers back to figure out what's going on. And so you do get... There are certain judges and there are certain rulings that are, you know, quite fair in the midst of all this mostly bias as I see it. You have to admit that it does happen sometimes.
Oh, it really does. And I must say, I have no experience in courtrooms, Denny. One time, a number of decades ago, I think it was back in the early 1970s, I was asked to be a witness for the defense in a case I have no recollection of, and I showed up in court, and I took my seat on the stand, and I was asked to the introductory questions, and the other side immediately objected. I don't remember the reason why, but they literally threw me out as a defense witness for whatever point they raised, and that was my only experience in a courtroom. And my feeling at the time was, I mean, I was willing to be a witness for the defense. I can't remember the issue, but I thought it was something just, and I was happy to cooperate and help. But they never let me get a word out,
right,
answering a single question.
That's the
Nothing
first
I could
thing.
Say was permitted.
Yeah, that's the first thing they do is they question the admissibility of the evidence, or they question
my admissibility.
Yeah. In other words, there's so many ways that they can do that, and of course that's the first thing they do. But it's rare that they're actually able to throw a witness out. Usually, those attacks are used to diminish the weight of your evidence, but they can't actually bar you from giving the evidence. You know, so that's unusual that they would have succeeded in actually barring you from giving evidence.
There was a debate about it. The attorney who asked me to be a witness, it seemed to me that it was very quick once the objection happened and the judge ruled for the other side. Bingo! It was over. I was off the stand, on to the next witness.
Right.
Well, so I don't know what the defense attorney had on his mind, but that was the one experience.
Once the ruling is made, there's not much he can say, right? Once the ruling is made, you have to go the formal appeal route, which is long and tedious, right? Yeah. But lawyers will often let things go that are not just to their own side, just because of the loss of time and energy to argue it out if it's not important, or so they lose resources, right? Or because even if it's truly not fair towards you, to fight against it would make it look like you're insecure about that evidence, or, you know, would give a bad impression. Sometimes they'll let it go for that reason, you see. So it's a real game. It's a battle. It's like a chess game. But, all this stuff happens.
Oh, it really does happen, and that's why lawyers are so well paid, especially the big firms, Denny. I can just imagine the amount of money they get. And when you're dealing with a deep-pocketed institution like any university, University of Ottawa, of course, I mean, they literally can fund any amount they want.
Yeah. Well, I've calculated... I'm able to find this out because when I lose a motion in court, they get to extract money from me to pay for the legal fees of the other side, even though it's being funded by the University of Ottawa. So they have to request that those funds be extracted from me, and so they have to show their bills, in a sense. They have to claim the money that they spent. And recently I added all that up. You know, we're not even near trial yet. We're not even in the pretrial process. We're still just doing preliminary motions. And so far I added it up. And just the part that they could claim from me, which is about half of everything they're spending, because there's a lot that they can't claim from me. All the work they do, all the research they do, preparing the legal documents that are not related to motions, all that work is not something that they can charge me. So I figure it's about half of what they spent so far, and it adds up to about $500,000. So it means that just setting up some of the preliminary motions as they move forward with this big machine, it's taken 2 years. They have spent about $1 million suing me. The University of Ottawa has spent about as much as, you know, it would cost to start building a significant building on campus to sue me because of a blog post, because I criticized one of their professors and the president of the university for something that they had done, and they decided to sue me.
And it was a very just criticism, Denny, and as you know, I wrote about it, literally to say something that you can say it needs to be said, but it certainly is proper what you said. And they sued you, and they've spent $1 million so far. I simply can't imagine how much they'll spend to run this thing to conclusion. But as you've explained on this program, they're willing to spend what it takes.
Well, I'm not going to let go. I'm not going to bend to their pressure. And so they're going to have to, you know, take it to the end or mediate a just settlement of some kind. But, I'm not just going to bend. That's what they want. They pressure you, and they try to intimidate you by all kinds of methods. Just incredible, the intimidation tactics as I understand them. I mean, that's what I see them to be, and it's pretty clear to me that that's what it is, are pretty horrendous. So there are some very difficult moments when you're being sued like this.
I've never gone through it, Denny, so I simply can't imagine, other than what you've discussed and things that I've read. I do know when it comes to slap lawsuits, they just want to weigh you down. They literally can keep going as long as they want, and they go up against others that don't have the same ability that they do. So they simply want to grind you down until the other side can't do anymore. Usually it means they've run out of money, and they don't have a source of any new funding. So that's the end of the story. The other side loses, and you're holding on valiantly.
Yeah, I'm doing the best I can. But in addition to the lengthiness of the process and how costly it is, they also do things like, you know, you're forced into what's called required mediation at one point. You know, it's required by the court rules. You have to try to mediate a settlement. And what they do is they use that session. They walk in there with six lawyers. You're alone. And because you're self-represented, you're not allowed to bring anyone with you. They could allow you moral support, but they have to agree, and they didn't, so I was alone. And so there's this five or six of them sitting on one side, and you're on the other side. And you can imagine what that session is like, because it's completely private. The court's not allowed to know anything that was said there. And, you know, there's virtually no way you can complain about how the thing was run, except to, you know, you have to... The mediator, who's hired by both sides, asks you to sign a waiver that you will never try to call her as a witness for anything. So you can't rely on her if something improper happens, and so on. Right? So, you know, what I feel is that a lot of this is designed to be intimidation, and it's horrible. So I put a stop to it at one point. I said, okay, if this is how it's going to be, I'm walking out. And then I was able to calm them down, and we at least tried to, present each other's mediation proposals and so on. But, that's part of how it goes. But let me tell you about something else. I want to come back to my hearings in the dismissal case. Because that dismissal case, I was dismissed from my full professorship. I was tenured full professor of physics at the University of Ottawa, and I was dismissed in 2009. And just now we're into the final tribunal hearings. And this week there was an interesting battle, a legal battle, as part of those hearings that, I learned something that I was a bit shocked by it. But here's how it goes. The university wanted to be able to cross-examine me on anything they wanted. They wanted to be able to ask the broadest possible questions to attack my credibility, my character, and whether or not I was suited to be a university professor. And so they just wanted to go after me, basically. And the union objected to these lines of questioning. And so the arbitrator heard legal arguments from both sides. And so detailed legal arguments were presented and replies, all in writing, as to why these types of questions should not be permitted. And the university argued that, of course, they should be permitted, and so on. And then when we came back on the Tuesday, the arbitrator had decided and told us his ruling. And his ruling was that he was going to allow all these questions, all these broad questions, and then apply the criterion of what was admissible after he heard the evidence. At least that's how I understood his ruling. So the cross-examination continued like that. And the way they were cross-examining me was to go and get my blog articles that criticized the university, U of O Watch blog, and also my blog articles about radical pedagogy, which is on the activist teacher blog, and to cross-examine me about, you know, doesn't this mean that you condone violence? Doesn't this mean that you incite violence? Are you an anarchist, sir? You know, and all this kind of stuff. And so I had to patiently go through and explain that anarchism was a political theory, that people like Noam Chomsky and Gandhi was a self-proclaimed anarchist. And so I had to explain these things, and explain what the political theory was to some extent, that there was a distinction to be made between the street meaning of anarchy, which is just chaos, and so on, and the political theory, and how I'd been invited to talk about this at conferences, and how, and so on. And but this is the level that I had to defend myself at, in order to defend against this basically just mudslinging is all it was. And so blog article after blog article, and of course my blogs are critiques, and they have sting, and they're meant to be provocative, and so on. And so they've got a lot of material there to pick from. And I recently wrote about this. On the latest blog article on U of O Watch is these latest questions from the university. And so I've given the links to the blogs that they've used to try to show that, you know, I'm just not suited to be a university professor. You know, it's about perverting the youth somehow, you know, and I kept explaining to them. I said, listen, university students are adults. They can discern things. They know when they're reading a blog what the theme of the blog is and what it's about, and they can decide if they want to read it all or not. And they don't just get a first impression from a title and take that to be something solid that they now believe. And you know, I have to explain all of this to them. Their starting assumption is that we're in kindergarten and that these are vulnerable, you know, 5-year-olds that you have to be careful which words you use or they might be perturbed for half a day, you know. This is the level at which I have to explain these things. It's frightening, really. There was one incident in particular that really shocked me, because your listeners will recall that the university had hired a student to be a spy, to basically report on everything, you know, student politics, students that I knew that were involved in student politics, what they had been saying, how their campaigns were going, what I had been doing on the weekend, what talks I had given on other campuses and what the content of those talks were. I mean, they were prepared to fly this spy to UBC in British Columbia, University of British Columbia, where I was giving a talk, just to be able to report on what the talk was. And so this spy was active in 2007 and 2008, and she basically followed my every move. Anytime I spoke out in public, anytime I did anything, she would write weekly reports to the Dean of Science and the Legal Counsel of the university. This is quite a campaign, and she was hired to do this. And she would joke about how she actually took on a false identity on the internet and called herself a different name and would try to befriend students that were on various Facebook groups and activist groups and political groups in order to extract information from them. And she used a false email account, and sometimes she used her email account. She had been a student journalist. Sometimes she used that if it was useful. And so she used these techniques that involve you know, false identity and asking for things under false pretense, and collected all this information. The dean testified that the information filled an entire wall cabinet in his office of the information that they had collected about me and that she had organized. And so I gave a talk at Queen's University, which is some 200 kilometers from Ottawa here, one time, and this student wrote a report about it. And I thought, they won't use this report because it's obtained in this way and it's prepared by a student spy who, in the emails that we see, admits to having a personal grudge against me. And so they hired someone after she admitted she had a personal grudge against me for ideological reasons and because of some of the things I'd said and so on. And they hired her to be this student, and here she is producing this report about a talk I gave, selecting parts that I might have said and so on. And so They actually put that before the tribunal and said, here, we want this to be an exhibit. We want to cross-examine Dr. Doncourt on it. Now, I said, I objected. I mean, I'm just a witness, but I said, I want to see the full document. I want all the information, and I want to know where this is from. I want to see the documents that are attached to this, and so on. And the arbitrator said, ruled that, no, I just needed to answer the questions on that document. Now, apparently that's allowed. I mean, think of it. This is a university. There's something called academic freedom, which means the employer, the executives of the university, cannot interfere with your work. They can't interfere with what you say, with how you teach your courses, with how you do your research. They can't interfere with your political opinions. They can't interfere with anything. This kind of spying is the antithesis of academic freedom. It's the most, you know, apart from outright firing someone, it's as far as you can go in terms of interfering with a professor's professional life. And by these methods, they collected this information, and now they're allowed to use it against you. And it's acceptable to do it that way.
Denny, it's shocking and it's disgusting. And I looked up, I wrote about it twice in articles that I wrote about you. There is such a thing for non-Canadians called the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And in Section 2B, among other things, it says the fundamental freedoms include freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of thought, belief, opinion, expression, freedom of the press, et cetera, and so forth, freedom of the media, freedom of communication. Well, University of Ottawa stands guilty in all of those things. Denny, let's take a short break, and we'll come back, and we'll pick right back up again.
Okay.
Talking with Denny Rancourt, talking about his trials and tribulations. Denny, before you continue, let me just mention one thing. Today is an important day for at least two reasons. There certainly is an awful lot going on around the world that is very, very disturbing. One thing that is hopefully a glorious event, and I wrote about it, and another one, two things today signifies. On the one hand, today is a march, a global march against Monsanto. And I wrote an article this morning that I'll get out tomorrow, and I call it Monsanto, Profits Above Human Health. Well, there are tens of thousands of people around the world in dozens of countries marching against Monsanto for all the reasons that they have in mind, good reasons. They want safe food and so on. And today is another day I didn't know anything about until I noticed a brief account of it on one website. The day is Lebanon's Victory Day of National Resistance. It ended 22 years of Israeli occupation. Direct occupation, proxy occupation, began in 1978, ended in May 2000, and today is the day it's commemorated. But I must say, Denny, I just looked up a Lebanon website, a Daily Star publication that I check often to see what's going on in Lebanon. They don't even mention this, at least it didn't in the stuff that I took a look at, unless they have it buried somewhere that I haven't seen. Well, here I'm writing an article about it. I consider it important to mention. It's their country, Denny, and the newspaper didn't even mention it. I'm going to have to check out the Lebanese media to see if they talk about their own Victory Day. Anyway, let me let you continue.
Right, right. Well, who knows what the reasons behind that are, but yeah,
well,
a lot going on.
Denny, I began my article on Lebanon, quoting a former president of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz, 19th century, early 20th century. Reportedly, he once said, "Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States." And then my next line was, "Poor Mexico, it borders Israel." it borders Syria at the wrong time, and so on and so forth. Then I continued my article, but let me let you pick up.
Right, right. Well, yeah. I mean, these big players, it's all connected, isn't it? I mean, these big world players and that do the strategy, that support the system of exploitation and so on.
Oh, absolutely.
When they fail, you name them as presidents of universities, and you give them positions like that. You know?
Well, Alan Rock, a former government official for Canada, a UN ambassador. Now, he just stayed in politics. Politicians have no business.
Well, he had to flee politics. There were a lot of controversies and scandals in relation to ethical breaches that he.
So he thought he found a safe haven.
Well, they sent him off to be at the United Nations, Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. So one of his friends, who was in power at the time, sent him off to do that in order to quiet things down. But he clearly went from being, you know, a potential candidate to be prime minister. To being put away somewhere because there were all these scandals that were being talked about in the media, where he was told by the formal federal ethics commissioner, you know, don't do this, and then he'd go ahead and do it, and then of course the media would report it when they found out and so on, and I mean there were all these things happening with the guy. I mean, I don't understand how the selection committee at the university could have not done a simple Google search to look for things in this man's past before they recommended him for president. I actually blogged about that. You know, how is it possible? Is it that difficult to do a Google search and to try to find if there's anything that the university would be embarrassed about and that could be harmful to the institution before you hire someone to be president, you know? But and actually that was one of the blogs that they used to cross-examine me on. You know what the questions were? Did you consider that this critical blog could be hurtful of Mr. Rock's feelings?
Danny, it really is shocking, and I must say that my esteemed university, way, way back, I mean, they hired distinguished academics to be presidents of the university, and they lowered their standards, and some years ago, they hired the former, he was in the Clinton administration, Larry Summers, an economist, who, among other disreputable things that he did, he was very disparaging of women and women's rights. He wanted toxins like uranium waste and so on dumped in poor countries like African countries, and he actually said these things publicly. He so embarrassed the university, they finally couldn't put up with him anymore, and they got rid of him and replaced him. But why they ever hired him in the first place, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that's a university that had at least a board of governors with a backbone that could get rid of a president, but there's nothing like that at the University of Ottawa.
It's shameful because they did get rid of Larry Summers. I'm sure they did it gracefully. They simply replaced him, or he stepped down. You know, the voluntary stepping down, but they replaced him and somebody else came in. But you still don't see the kind of distinguished academics filling these posts. They want somebody who has some kind of a reputation where he's got some clout or she has some clout in some form or other. And the main idea for a university president, certainly in America, is to be a key fundraiser.
Maybe
it's true in Canada also.
Well, in Canada, at the University of Ottawa, you know, if you look at what Rock has done since he's arrived within his mandate, and it was the first time that they hired out one of these guns from the outside. It was the first time it was not an academic from the institution itself that rose to be president. So it's quite a corporatization, if you like, of the university that has occurred in this new mandate. But what he did was he transformed a university which was legally its mission is to support the Franco minority within English Canada, and to be there for Ontario students and so on. It's a major university in Ontario. He transformed it into an international flagship university to support the image of Israel, to have exchange programs with Israel, this kind of thing, and to try to attract students from other countries and make it international, instead of focusing on having the best possible education for regional and local students. He made it into a kind of international project where they send people around the world to try to attract foreign students who will pay huge tuition fees to come to this university and thereby increase the funding of the university and so on. They wanted to go there, so they went from quality at a public institution to trying to recruit and trying to sell their image wherever it can be useful. Basically, it's quite disturbing to see the institution being transformed in this way. I forget what he called it, but he had some slogan with regards to opening up to the world or something. That's what they do. They take over these institutions and then they steer them towards serving these other interests than the primary mission of the university.
It's a shame, Danny, and yeah. it's both a political initiative and a way of raising funds, and it veers away from the role a university should play. It's an academic place. It's a place of teaching and learning, and that seems to be a secondary function compared to these other things. And there's no question that Canada as a country is so supportive one-sidedly for Israel, and by doing that, so disparaging of Palestinians. And of course, you stood up so strongly, so heroically for Palestinian rights, and I guess that was the main reason you got in trouble. It certainly wasn't because of anything you did in the classroom.
No, that was, the classroom things they used as a pretext. This allegation that I was grading my students in one class, gave fraudulent grades, that's completely crazy. But, I mean, they want to believe it and they pursue it, but I think that's a pretext for the real reasons, which they don't tell you what they are. But I guess there's a lot of things that in what I was doing that they didn't like, so I guess you could pick and choose what the real reasons were. But it's terrible. It's terrible.
Well, it's the same down here. There have been a lot of professors at universities, including in Chicago, who simply supported the things the university was against, and they got themselves in trouble, and they found themselves dismissed or harassed or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very unjust situation, and it's not a one-time thing. It just happens much, much too often.
Well, my own personal insight into this is that one time I was interviewed on television, and it turned out during the call-in period, a student called and said he had been screamed at by the president, Alan Rock, and turned out the TV station had done its research, and they knew about this, and they actually had the recording of the president screaming at the student because it had been made public by the student. And they played that on television while I was being interviewed. And then, and it was a very, visceral yelling at the student in a very aggressive way, and to send him out of the office and so on, because the student was complaining about how he had been mistreated in his study program. But anyway, then the announcer, the person interviewing me, asked me, what do you think of this, Professor Doncourt? And I said, well, I was very blunt. I said, if a professor ever treated a student that way, they would be fired. It's that simple. This is completely unacceptable, I said. And I was talking about the president of my university. Well, within about a week, I was locked out of my laboratory. I was prevented from going in there and doing my research. They changed the locks on the door and so on, without warning me, without telling me. And within weeks of that, or months, I was told that I was being dismissed. So not only did I write articles, not only did I make criticisms that they didn't appreciate, have political views that they didn't like, but I was also very blunt. If you asked me my opinion about the behavior of some of the executives at the university, I gave my opinion. And this was, in terms of the chronology, it appears to have been a consequence of that. But you all never know these things. They never tell you.
Oh, they never will, and very likely that, and probably other things, that the black marks that they compile against you, Danny, all the good things that you do and others do go down in somebody's black book as marks against you, and they use it against you if they want to.
Well, they do take notes. That's right. I mean, I once, through access to information, got some of these notes, because they slipped, the person putting it together slipped it in by accident into the part of the documents that I was allowed to get. I got these notes of a high-ranking official notes during a meeting about me. They had called a meeting just about me, and they were taking notes, and I actually got to see this notepad. It was quite remarkable, these were just scratched notes at a meeting, but when I looked at it, it looked like they were blaming me for everything that was happening on campus that they didn't like, you know. They were associating my name with everything they didn't like on campus.
Well, they can certainly do it, and if they want to go out to get you, they can find many, many ways to do it.
Yeah.
And they made you a marked man because of what you stood for and the fact that you were courageous enough to come out and say it. Well, I say it all the time. I don't have a job I have to hold on to, fear of being fired or whatever, but I'm sure that everything I do, Denny, my writing, my media work, I'm sure the dark forces that I talk about and write about, I'm sure they monitor me, and they compile their own dossiers
well,
on
yeah,
me.
Well, yeah, it depends. It depends what flags have been raised. They probably monitor hundreds of thousands of people, and if there came a point where you were identified as a possible threat, then they would have investigated you. And then they would decide if we need to keep monitoring this person or just let it go until you know, just once a year maybe we'll look into what he's doing. But they make these decisions, and I've seen it. I mean, I've given talks on campuses where I'm certain that there were people in the room that were specifically there to surveil and to report on what I was saying. And I don't think they were always just university hired spies, you know. But that's the way it goes. That's the kind of society we live in. We live in a society where the state spends enormous resources just keeping tabs on us all and looking for the signs of people that you have to look into.
Well, Denny, I've written about it in America, using language, institutionalized spying, where literally everybody can be surveilled. They can do it online. They can do it. They can tap your phones. They can have cameras in streets, in shopping malls, in business places. They literally can be watching you anywhere. And the notion of Big Brother that Orwell wrote about over half a century ago. I mean, Big Brother really is here today. And the technology available are things that I don't imagine Orwell could have even imagined.
That's
you
right.
Conjure
yeah.
up
yeah.
all kinds of things, but the technology is extraordinary, and they literally can watch all. What they do with all this information, I don't know, but they certainly gather an awful lot of it.
Yeah. Now, you know, we were talking about the university spy in my case a while back, and I found an email that was. It was required to be disclosed by the university because they wanted to use this spy material, so they had to disclose the relevant things. And this is just a remarkable email. I want to tell you about it, if that's okay.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so here we are in March of 2008, and the spy, her name is Maureen Robinson, but she's using a fake name, which is Natalie Page. And so she's writing an email from her fake email, the Natalie Page email, to the chief counsel of the university and the dean of the Faculty of Science, okay? And she, in her email, she says, "Hi, it's Natalie, ha ha ha." She uses her fake name. She says, "Hi, it's Natalie, ha ha ha." That's how she introduces herself. In other words, both this top lawyer at the university and the dean know that she's using a false identity, and she knows that they know, okay? So she says, "Hi, it's Natalie." You know, she's very open about the technique she's using, okay? And then she says in brackets, "You know," and I may have read this on your show before, but it's just such a striking email. She says, "You know, posing as a smiling schoolgirl to get information makes me feel like those police officers who pose as 9-year-old girls online to catch pedophiles." 3 points, close of brackets. That's how she starts her message to the chief counsel and to the dean of science. So it gives you a sense of the kind of weekly reporting that she was giving them.
Well, this is really astonishing. If anybody is doing this about me, Denny, I am completely unaware of it, and I think I would be just as shocked and dismayed and upset as you are if I found it out. And I really believe that because of what I'm doing, I am monitored, but I've never seen any physical evidence to prove it. I've been told by other people who are more savvy about these things than I am. I was told quite a long time ago that you can be sure, because of what you do, that you're watched, and they read your stuff, they follow your media work, your programs, your interviews. Well, I'm in the public domain, Denny, and you are as well. So
yeah.
Nothing I do is covert. I'm completely in the open. So if anybody wants to monitor me, it's a piece of cake.
Well, that kind of general monitoring, I think, you know, they're going to do it and let them do it, you know, and The only way you cannot be seen is to not ever go on the internet and so on, which we're not going to do. We need these tools, right? But what they were doing with me, though, is a university hiring a student to actually write reports every week. It's unbelievable. So, now, in this same email, she also get this, in the PS, she gives the dean the password to the fake identity account that she's using to enter various Google groups of student activists. Because she says she's going to be away on vacation, so if the dean wants to go in and pretend that he's her, here's the password. What do you think of that?
Well,
you know?
They will do whatever they want to do, Denny. They'll go as far as they want to go. I mean, when they decide they want to get you, they're gonna go all the way to do it.
It's just incredible that this kind of activity. So if they can use this kind evidence that comes from this kind of a process when they go after you in order to tar you, in order to suggest that a talk you gave at another campus was evidence of something wrong or of what you really believe and think, and therefore, you know, given those thoughts, we can't possibly hire you back. If they can, they're entitled to use this, the result of this process. I mean, I may be naive, but my feeling is, if you're going to spy on a professor, and if you're going to use these kinds of very unsavory methods that go against the principle that the university is founded upon, which is academic freedom, then you cannot use any of this material against the professor ever in any way. I don't care what it says. You know, in terms of these academic questions, I mean. Of course, if you have evidence that someone is committing a crime, then you have a responsibility to report it. That's a different question. But this is a game of thought policing and trying to figure out what is in this person's mind when he gives a talk in order to argue that they're not suited to be a university professor. I mean, it's frightening. And if the material was collected in this way, there should be, I mean, a basic principle that says, look, here's the founding principle. This was against it. Therefore, we're not going to allow you to use it. I mean, that seems pretty clear to me. If I was an accused criminal, I'd have more protection than this, because they can't do this kind of thing in a criminal case. They can't use evidence that was obtained in any improper way. It's clear. It's barred. Period. It's done. You know, doesn't the person, even in a murder case, you can't use the evidence. So that seems like a pretty reasonable principle. If the crime is a thought crime, and they're trying to attack your character to say that even though you were tenured, you can't come back, then the method for deducing the thought crime should be relevant. And if it's improper, the thought crime evidence should not be admissible. This is my simple thinking of it. Of course, the legal people have a whole different analysis and doesn't go through this loop. But that's, there. You know, I have to say, I believe the arbitrator in my case is a highly professional, highly ethical decision maker who looks at the evidence, who strictly follows the rules of the procedure, and, you know, does the best job that he can in a highly professional and ethical way. I really believe that. You can see it in the questions he asks, in his attitude at the tribunal, in the way that he always fairly, you know, weighs things and is able to decide on the spot and so on. He makes sure that the process doesn't get polluted. But within the rules that they're using, they're allowed to do this. They're allowed to use this kind of evidence. And that I find very disturbing, that the rules as they exist and as they apply to an academic setting would allow this. I find very disturbing. And I was distraught when I realized that they were going to introduce this kind of evidence. I was distraught. Now, I was ordered to answer the questions, so I went on to explain what my thoughts were and what these words meant and what the context was and so on. But I couldn't help be distraught by the fact that they were able to pull this, you know, use these methods and then actually use the evidence that came from those methods.
Denny, we are out of time. It really is shocking and disturbing. And here they can do it to you one-on-one. It shows that they simply have no conscience whatsoever. They can go after an individual for any reason. They can go after a country for any reason. And this is the stuff that goes on. And Canada is part of this dirty alliance with America. America, the lead belligerent. Denny, we're out of time. I want to remind listeners to tune in tomorrow at the same time and to make this program a regular habit. And Denny, I look forward to getting you back so we can continue letting listeners know what kind of a gross injustice happens, because if it can happen to you, Denny, it can happen to anybody, and it's happening to lots of people right now. Many thanks, Denny.
Well, it was a pleasure. It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.